stand. Another Goffman expert. Mooneyham is sharpening his knives. Should be ugly. Do you believe the rumor? I'm not sure what to believe. The Wall Street boys seem excited about it. They want a settlement because they figure that's the best way to predict costs. I'll call you back. The next morning, Clay was taken back to surgery for some minor adjustments to the pins and screws in his legs. He returned to his room just after noon and slept for 3 hours before the drugs wore off. An overnight envelope arrived unopened, from Patton French, a handwritten note passed along his best wishes for a speedy recovery and something else that Clay could not decipher. The attached memo was to the Dyloft Plaintiff Steering Committee, now defendants. The Honorable Helen Warshaw had submitted her weekly additions to her class action. The list was growing. Residual Dyloft damage was popping up all over the nation, and the defendants were seeking deeper into the quicksand. There were now 381 members of the class, with 24 of them ex-JCC clients who'd signed up with Ms. Warshaw, up 3 from the week before. Ridley finally stopped by on her way home from the gym. She hauled in some books and magazines and tried to appear concerned. After a few minutes, she said, "Clay, the decorator called. I need to return to the villa." Was the decorator male or female? He pondered the question, but did not ask. "When?" he asked. "Tomorrow, maybe, if the plane is available." Why wouldn't it be available? Clay certainly wasn't going anywhere. "Sure, I'll call the pilots." Getting her out of town would make his life easier. She was of no benefit around the hospital. "Thanks," she said, then sat in the chair and began flipping through a magazine. After 30 minutes her time was up. She kissed him on the forehead and disappeared. The detective was next. 3 men from Reedsburg had been arrested early Sunday morning outside a bar in Hagerstown, Maryland. There had been a fight of some sort. The detective produced 3 color photos of the suspects, all rough-looking characters. Clay could not identify any of them. They worked at the Hanna plant, according to the chief of police in Reedsburg. 2 had recently been laid off, but that was the only information the detective had managed to extract from the authorities up there. "If you can't identify these guys, then I have no choice but to close the file," the detective said. "I've never seen them before," Clay said. Oscar called around 9:30 p.m. The trial had just adjourned for the day. Everyone was exhausted, primarily because Dale Mooneyham had caused such massive carnage in the courtroom. "It's an old-fashioned rum-pumping," Oscar laughed. "Goffman should be afraid to call any more witnesses." "Settlement?" Clay asked, drugged and sluggish and sleepy, but trying desperately to catch the details. "No, but it should be a long night. Rumor is that Goffman might try one more expert tomorrow, then plug the dike and hunt it down for the verdict. Mooneyham refuses to talk to them. He looks and acts as if he expects a record verdict." Clay passed out with the phone wedged against the side of his head. A nurse removed it an hour later. Goffman's CEO arrived in Flagstaff late Wednesday night and was rushed downtown to a tall building where the lawyers were conspiring. He was briefed by Roger Redding and the rest of the defense team and shown the latest numbers by the boys in finance. Every discussion was centered around a doomsday scenario. Because Redding's rear end had been so thoroughly whipped, he was adamant that the defense stick to its game plan and call its remaining witnesses. He wanted to push on, hoping for a miracle. But to follow him was bad advice. As bad as things were for the company, there remained some secrets about Maxitol that could never be revealed. If Mooneyham had this information, or if he could beat it out of a witness, then the sky would indeed fall on Goffman. The CEO finally made the decision to stop the bloodletting. When court was called to order at 9 a.m., Roger Redding announced that the defense would rest. "No further witnesses?" the judge asked. A 15-day trial had just been cut in half. "That's correct, Your Honor," Redding said with a smile at the jurors as if all was well. "Any rebuttal, Mr. Mooneyham?" The plaintiff's lawyer slowly got to his feet. He scratched his head, scowled at Redding, and said, "If they're done, then so are we." The judge explained to the jurors that they would be in recess for an hour while he took up some matters with the lawyers. When they returned, they would hear the closing arguments, and by lunchtime, they would have the case. With everyone else, Oscar ran into the hallway, clutching a cell phone. There was no answer in Clay's hospital room. Clay was napping when Oscar called. It was 5:20 his time, 3:20 in Phoenix. "Where have you been?" Oscar demanded.
"X-ray. What's happening?"
"Goffman threw in the towel first thing this morning. Tried to settle, but Mooneyham wouldn't talk. Everything happened real fast after that. Closing arguments began around 10, I guess. The jury got the case at exactly noon."
"The jury has the case?" Clay asked, practically yelling at the phone.
"Had."
"What?"
"Had the case. It's over. They deliberated for 3 hours and found in favor of Goffman."
"I'm sorry, Clay.
Everybody here is in shock."
"No."
"Afraid so."
"Tell me you're lying, Oscar."
"I wish. I don't know what happened. Nobody does. Redding gave a spectacular closing argument, but I watched the jurors. I thought Mooneyham had them."
"Dale Mooneyham lost a case?"
"Not just any case, Clay. He lost our case."
"But how?"
"I don't know. I would have bet the farm against Goffman."
"We just did."
"I'm sorry."
"Look, Oscar, I'm lying here in bed all alone. I'm closing my eyes now, and I want you to just talk to me, okay? Don't leave me. There's no one else around. Just talk to me. Tell me something."
"After the verdict, I got cornered by their lawyers. Real sweet boys. They were so happy they were about to pop. They began by asking if you're still alive. How do you like that? Then they sent their regards, real sincere-like. They told me that they're bringing their show on the road, Roger the Dodger and Company, and the next trial will be in D.C. against Mr. Clay Carter, the King of Torts, who, as we all know, has never tried a tort case."
"Our cases are worthless, Oscar."
"They certainly think so. Mitchell said they would not offer 1 cent for any Maxitil case anywhere in the country. They want trials. They want vindication. A clear name. All that crap."
He kept Oscar on the phone for over an hour, as his unlit room grew dark. Oscar replayed the closing arguments and the high tension of waiting for the verdict. He described the shock on the plaintiff's face. A dying woman whose lawyer wouldn't take whatever Goffman was offering, supposedly $10 million. And Mooneyham, who hadn't lost in so long he had forgotten how to lose, demanding that the jury be required to fill out questionnaires and explain themselves. Oscar ended his narrative with, "I'm going to a bar now." Clay called a nurse and asked for a sleeping pill. After 11 days of confinement, Clay was finally set free. A lighter cast was placed on his left leg, and though he couldn't walk, he could at least maneuver a little. Paulette pushed his wheelchair out of the hospital to a rented van driven by Oscar. 15 minutes later, they rolled him into his townhouse and locked the door. Paulette and Miss Glick had turned the downstairs den into a temporary bedroom. His phones, fax, and computer had been moved to a folding table near his bed. His clothes were stacked neatly on plastic shelves by the fireplace. For the first 2 hours he was home, he read mail and financial reports and clippings, but only what Paulette had screened. Most of what had been printed about Clay was kept away from him. Later, after a nap, he sat at the kitchen table with Paulette and Oscar and announced that it was time to start. The unraveling began. The first issue was his law firm. Criddle had managed to trim a few costs, but the overhead was still galloping along at $1 million a month. With no current revenues and none expected, immediate layoffs were unavoidable. They went down a list of the employees. Lawyers, paralegals, secretaries, clerks, gophers, and made the painful cuts. Though they considered the Maxitil cases worthless, it would still take work to close the files. Clay kept 4 lawyers and 4 paralegals for the job. He was determined to honor every contract he'd signed with his employees, but to do so would eat up some badly needed cash. Clay looked at the names of the employees who had to go, and it made him ill. "I want to sleep on this," he said, unable to make the final decision.
"Most of them are expecting it, Clay," Paulette said.
He stared at the names and tried to imagine the gossip that had been raging about him in the halls of his own firm. 2 days earlier, Oscar had reluctantly agreed to go to New York and meet with Helen Warshaw. He had presented a broad picture of Clay Carter's assets and potential liabilities, and basically begged for mercy. His boss did not want to file for bankruptcy, but if pushed too hard by Ms. Warshaw, he would have no choice. She had been unimpressed. Clay was a member of a group of lawyers, her defendants, with a combined net worth that she estimated at $1.5 billion. She could not allow Clay to settle his cases for, say, a meager $1 million each, when the same cases against Pat and French might fetch three times that much. Plus, she was not in a settling mood. The trial would be an important one, a bold effort at reforming abuses in the system, a media-hyped spectacle. She planned to savor every moment of it. Oscar returned to D.C. with his tail between his legs, certain that Helen Warshaw, as the lawyer for Clay's biggest group of creditors, wanted blood. The dreaded word bankruptcy had first been uttered by Rex Criddle in Clay's hospital room. It had cut through the air like a bullet and landed like a mortar. Then it was used again. Clay began saying it, but only to himself. Paulette said it once. Oscar had used it in New York. It didn't fit, and they didn't like it, but over the past week it had become part of their vocabulary. The office lease could be terminated, through bankruptcy. The employment contracts could be compromised, through bankruptcy. The Gulf Stream could be sent back on better terms, through bankruptcy. The disgruntled Maxitil clients could be stiff-armed, through bankruptcy. The disgruntled Hanna plaintiffs could be convinced to settle, through bankruptcy. And most important, Helen Warshaw could be reined in through bankruptcy. Oscar was almost as depressed as Clay, and after a few hours of misery, he left for the office. Paulette rolled Clay outside and onto the small patio where they had a cup of green tea with honey. "I got two things to say," she said, sitting very close and staring at him. "First, I'm going to give you some of my money." "No, you're not." "Yes, I am. You made me rich when you didn't have to. I can't help it that you're a stupid white boy who's lost his ass, but I still love you. I'm going to help you, Clay." "Can you believe this, Paulette?" "No, it's beyond belief, but it's true. It's happened. And things will get much worse before they get better. Don't read the papers, Clay. Please, promise me that." "Don't worry. I'm going to help you. If you lose everything, I'll be around to make sure you're okay." "I don't know what to say." "Say nothing." They held hands and Clay fought back tears. A moment passed. "Number two," she said. "I've been talking to Rebecca. She's afraid to see you because she might get caught. She's got a new cell phone, one her husband knows nothing about. She gave me the number. She wants you to call her." Rebecca parked around the corner and hustled down Dumbarton Street to Clay's door. She was not good at sneaking around. Neither was he. The first thing they decided was that they would not continue it. She and Jason Myers had decided to dissolve their marriage amicably. He'd simply left her, with no apologies and no plans to change his constant traveling and 18-hour workdays. The papers would be filed in 2 days. She was already packing her bags. Jason would keep the condo. She had been vague on where she would go. In less than a year of marriage, they had accumulated little. He was a partner who made $800,000 a year, but she wanted none of his money. According to Rebecca, her parents had not interfered. They had not had the opportunity. Myers didn't like them, which was no surprise, and Clay suspected that one reason he preferred the firm's branch offices was because they were so far away from the Van Horns. Both had reason to run. Clay would not, under any circumstances, remain in D.C. in the years to come. His humiliation was too raw and deep, and there was a big world out there where people didn't know him. He craved anonymity. For the first time in her life, Rebecca just wanted to get away. Away from a bad marriage, away from her family, away from the country club and the insufferable people who went there, away from the pressures of making money and accumulating stuff, away from McLean and the only friend she'd ever known. It took an hour for Clay to get her in the bed, but sex was impossible, with the casts and all. He just wanted to hold her and kiss her and make up for lost time. She spent the night and decided not to leave. Over coffee the next morning, Clay began with Tequila Watson and Tarvan and told her everything. Paulette and Oscar returned with more unpleasantries from JCC. Clay's office was finalizing a settlement plan to be put before the judge in the Hanna bankruptcy. Oddly enough, the firm might be awarded a fee, though one far less than what Clay had turned down. There was an urgent Warshaw motion to take the depositions of several of the Dyloff plaintiffs. Urgency was required because they were dying, and their video depositions would be crucial to the trial, which was expected in about a year. Clay agreed to the schedule of depositions suggested by Ms. Warshaw, though he had no plans to attend them. Under pressure from Oscar, Clay finally agreed to lay off 10 lawyers and most of the paralegals, secretaries, and clerks. He signed letters to every one of them, brief and very apologetic. He took full responsibility for the demise of his firm. Frankly, there was no one else to blame. A letter to the Maxitil clients was hammered out. In it, Clay recapped the Mooneyham trial in Phoenix. He held to the belief that the drug was dangerous, but proving causation would now be, quote, very difficult, if not impossible, close quote. Clay couldn't help but think of Max Pace, his old pal who'd gotten him into the Maxitil business. Pace, one of at least 5 aliases, had been indicted for securities fraud, but had not been found. His indictment claimed that he used insider information to sell almost 1 million shares of Goffman before Clay filed suit. Later, he covered his sale and slipped out of the country with around $15 million. Run, Max, run! If he was caught and hauled back for a trial, he might spill all their dirty secrets. There were 100 other details on Oscar's checklist, but Clay grew weary. Am I playing nurse tonight? Paulette whispered in the kitchen. No, Rebecca's here. You love trouble, don't you? For the next week, Clay never left his townhouse. Rebecca packed all of Ridley's things into 30-gallon trash bags and stuffed them in the basement. She moved in some of her own stuff, though Clay warned her that he was about to lose the house. She cooked wonderful meals and nursed him whenever he needed it. They watched old movies until midnight, then slept late every morning. She drove him to see his doctor.
Ridley called every other day from St. Bart's.
Clay did not tell her she'd lost her place. He preferred to do that in person, when and if she returned. The renovation was coming along nicely, though Clay had seriously curtailed the budget. She seemed oblivious to his financial problems. The last lawyer to enter Clay's life was Mark Munson, a bankruptcy expert who specialized in large, messy individual crashes. Crittle had found him. After Clay retained him, Crittle showed him the books, the leases, the contracts, the lawsuits, the assets, and the liabilities. Everything. When Munson and Crittle came to the townhouse, Clay asked Rebecca to leave. He wanted to spare her the gruesome details. In the 17 months since he'd left OPD, Clay had earned $121 million in fees. $30 million had been paid to Rodney, Paulette, and Jonah as bonuses. $20 million had gone for office expenses and the Gulfstream. $16 million down the drain for advertising and testing for Dyloft, Maxitil, and Skinny Benz. $34 million for taxes, either paid or accrued. $4 million for the villa. $3 million for the sailboat. $1 million here and there, the townhouse, the loan to Max Pace, and the usual and expected extravagances of the newly rich. Jarrett's fancy new catamaran was an interesting issue. Clay had paid for it, but the Bahamian company that held its title was owned completely by his father. Munson thought the bankruptcy court might take one of two positions. Either it was a gift, which would require Clay to pay gift taxes, or it was simply owned by someone else and thus not part of Clay's estate. Either way, the boat remained the property of Jarrett Carter. Clay had also earned $7.1 million trading in Ackerman stock, and though some of this was buried offshore, it was about to be hauled back. "If you hide assets, you go to jail," Munson lectured, leaving little doubt that he did not tolerate such thinking. The balance sheet showed a net worth of approximately $19 million, with few creditors. However, the contingent liabilities were catastrophic. 26 former clients were now suing for the Dyloft fiasco. That number was expected to rise, and though it was impossible to throw darts at the value of each case, Clay's legitimate exposure was significantly more than his net worth. The Hanna class action plaintiffs were festering and getting organized. The Maxitil backlash would be nasty and prolonged. None of those expenses could be predicted, either. "Let the bankruptcy trustee deal with it," Munson said. "You'll walk away with the shirt on your back, but at least you won't owe anything." "Gee, thanks," Clay said, still thinking about the sailboat. If they were successful in keeping it away from the bankruptcy, then Jared could sell it, buy something smaller, and Clay could have some cash to live on.
Ridley called from St. Bart's with the alarming news that a for sale sign had appeared in front of their villa.
"That's because it's now for sale," Clay said. "I don't understand." "Come home and I'll explain it to you." "Is there trouble?" "You might say that." After a long pause, she said, "I'd prefer to stay here."
"I can't make you come home, Ridley."
"No, you can't."
"Fine. Stay in the villa until it sells. I don't care."
"How long will that be?"
He could see her doing everything imaginable to sabotage a potential sale. At the moment, Clay just didn't care. Maybe a month, maybe a year, I don't know.
"I'm staying," she said.
"Fine."
Rodney found his old friend sitting on the front steps of his picturesque townhouse, crutches by his side, a shawl over his shoulders to knock off the autumn chill. The wind was spinning leaves in circles along Dumbarton Street.
"Need some fresh air," Clay said. "I've been locked in there for 3 weeks."
"How are the bones?" Rodney asked as he sat beside him and looked at the street.
"Healing nicely."
Rodney had left the city and become a real suburbanite. Khakis and sneakers, a fancy SUV to haul kids around.
"How's your head?"
"No additional brain damage."
"How's your soul?"
"Tortured, to say the least, but I'll survive."
"Paulette says you're leaving."
"For a while, anyway. I'll file for bankruptcy next week, and I will not be around here when it happens. Paulette has a flat in London that I can use for a few months. We'll hide there."
"Clay, I want to help."
"I'm not taking your money."
"That's why you're here, and I know it. I've had this conversation twice with Paulette and once with Jonah. You made your money, and you were smart enough to cash out. I wasn't."
"But we're not going to let you die, man. You didn't have to give us $10 million, but you did. We're giving some back."
"No."
"Yes.
The three of us have talked about it. We'll wait until the bankruptcy is over, then each of us will do a transfer, a gift."
"You earned that money, Rodney. Keep it."
"Nobody earns $10 million in 6 months, Clay. You might win it, steal it, or have it drop out of the sky, but nobody earns money like that. It's ridiculous and obscene. I'm giving some back. So is Paulette. Not sure about Jonah, but he'll come around."
The Post reporter was Art Mariani, the young man who knew Clay Carter well because he documented his astounding rise and his equally amazing crash with careful attention to detail and a reasonable dose of fairness. When Mariani arrived at Clay's townhouse, he was greeted by Paulette and led down the narrow hall to the kitchen where folks were waiting. Clay hobbled to his feet and introduced himself, then went around the table. Zach Battle, his attorney, Rebecca Van Horn, his friend, and Oscar Mulrooney, his partner. Tape recorders were plugged in. Rebecca made the rounds with the coffee pot.
"It's a long story," Clay said, "but we have plenty of time."
"I have no deadline," Mariani said. Clay took a swig of coffee, a deep breath, and jumped into the story. He mentioned Tarvan by name, and his suspicion that it was made by Philo Products. The details poured forth, as did the documents and settlement agreements.
"When I publish this story, what happens to your clients, the families of the victims?" Mariani asked.
"I've lost sleep worrying about that, but I think they'll be fine," Clay said. "First, they've had the money for a year now, so it's safe to assume a lot of it has been spent. Second, the drug maker would be insane to try and set aside these settlements."
"The families could then sue the manufacturer directly," Zach added, helpfully.
"And those verdicts could destroy any big corporation. I've never seen a more volatile set of facts."
"The company won't touch the settlement agreements," Clay said. "It's lucky to get out with a $50 million settlement."
Mariani scribbled some notes and shifted gears.
"What happens to Tequila Watson, Rashad Porter, and the other men who were convicted of these murders?"
"First, they can probably sue the drug maker, which won't help them much in prison. Second, there's a chance their cases could be reopened, at least the sentencing aspect."
Zach Battle cleared his throat and everyone waited.
"Off the record. After you publish whatever you decide to publish, and after the storm dies down, I plan to take these cases and have them reviewed. I'll sue on behalf of the 7 defendants, that is, if we can definitely identify the pharmaceutical company.
I might petition the criminal courts to reopen their convictions.
This is very explosive, Mariani said, stating the obvious.
He studied his notes for a long time.
What led to the Dyloft litigation?
That's another chapter for another day, Clay said. You've documented most of it anyway. I'm not talking about it.
Fair enough. Is this story over?
For me it is, Clay said.
Paulette and Zach drove them to the airport, to Reagan National, where Clay's once-beloved Gulfstream sat very close to the spot where he'd first seen it. Since they were leaving for at least 6 months, there was a lot of luggage, especially Rebecca's. Clay, having shed so much in the past month, was traveling light. He got about fine with his crutches, but he couldn't carry anything. Zach acted as his porter. He gamely showed them his airplane, though they all knew this was its final voyage. Clay hugged Paulette and embraced Zach, thanked them both, and promised to call within days. When the co-pilot locked the door, Clay pulled the shades over the windows so he would see none of Washington when they lifted off. To Rebecca, the jet was a ghastly symbol of the destructive power of greed. She longed for the tiny flat in London, where no one knew them, and no one cared what they wore, drove, bought, ate, or where they worked, shopped, or vacationed. She wasn't coming home. She had fought with her parents for the last time. Clay longed for two good legs and a clean slate. He was surviving one of the more infamous meltdowns in the history of American law, and it was further and further behind him. He had Rebecca all to himself, and nothing else mattered. Somewhere over Newfoundland, they unfolded the sofa and fell asleep under the covers. This is Dennis Boutsakaris. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The King of Torts by John Grisham. This program was produced by David Rapkin and directed by Kathleen Hale. Executive producer Orly Moskowitz. Abridgment by Peter Michaelos. Text copyright 2003 by John Grisham. Production copyright 2003, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Random House Audio presents The Last Juror by John Grisham. Read for you by Terrence Mann. After decades of patient mismanagement and loving neglect, the Ford County Times went bankrupt in 1970. The owner and publisher, Miss Emma Caudle, was 93 years old and strapped to a bed in a nursing home in Tupelo. The editor, her son Wilson Caudle, was in his 70s and had a plate in his head from the First War. A perfect circle of dark grafted skin covered the plate at the top of his long sloping forehead. And throughout his adult life he had endured the nickname of Spot. Spot did this, Spot did that. Here Spot, there Spot. In his younger years, he covered town meetings, football games, elections, trials, church socials, all sorts of activities in Ford County. He was a good reporter, thorough and intuitive. Evidently, the head wound did not affect his ability to write. But sometime after the Second War, the plate apparently shifted, and Mr. Caudle stopped writing everything but the obituaries. He loved obituaries. He spent hours on them. He filled paragraphs of eloquent prose detailing the lives of even the humblest of Ford Countyans, and the death of a wealthy or prominent citizen was front-page news, with Mr. Caudle seizing the moment. He never missed a wake or a funeral, never wrote anything bad about anyone. All received glory in the end. Ford County was a wonderful place to die. And Spot was a very popular man, even though he was crazy. The only real crisis of his journalistic career happened in 1967, about the time the civil rights movement finally made it to Ford County. The paper had never shown the slightest hint of racial tolerance. No black faces appeared in its pages, except those belonging to known or suspected criminals. No black wedding announcements. No black honor students or baseball teams. But in 1967, Mr. Caudle made a startling discovery. He awoke one morning to the realization that black people were dying in Ford County, and their deaths were not being properly reported. There was a whole new fertile world of obituaries waiting out there, and Mr. Caudle set sail in dangerous and uncharted waters. On Wednesday, March 8, 1967, the Times became the first white-owned weekly in Mississippi to run the obituary of a Negro. For the most part, it went unnoticed. The following week, he ran three black obituaries, and people were beginning to talk. By the fourth week, a regular boycott was underway, with subscriptions being canceled and advertisers holding their money. Mr. Caudle knew what was happening, but he was too impressed with his new status as an integrationist to worry about such trivial matters as sales and profits. 6 weeks after the historic obituary, he announced, on the front page and in bold print, his new policy. He explained to the public that he would publish whatever he damned well pleased, and if the white folks didn't like it, then he would simply cut back on their obituaries. Now, dying properly is an important part of living in Mississippi, for whites and blacks, and the thought of being laid to rest without the benefit of one of Spot's glorious send-offs was more than most whites could stand, and they knew he was crazy enough to carry out his threat. The next edition was filled with all sorts of obituaries, blacks and whites all neatly alphabetized and desegregated. It sold out, and a brief period of prosperity followed. The bankruptcy was called involuntary, as if others had eager volunteers. The pack was led by a print supplier from Memphis that was owed $60,000. Several creditors had not been paid in 6 months. The old security bank was calling in a loan. I was new, but I'd heard the rumors. I was sitting on a desk in the front room of the Times offices reading a magazine when a midget in a pair of pointed toes strutted in the front door and asked for Wilson Caudle. "He's at the funeral home," I said. I pointed this way and that, and the man left. An hour later, Spot stumbled through the door, waving the papers and bawling hysterically. "It's over! It's over!" he kept wailing as I held the petition for involuntary bankruptcy. Margaret Wright, the secretary, and Hardy, the pressman, came from the back and tried to console him, but Spot was inconsolable. 5 minutes later, he left. 6 months later, I would write his obituary. Because I had attended college and because I was holding the papers, Hardy and Margaret looked hopefully at me for advice. I was a journalist, not a lawyer, but I said that I would take the papers to the Caudle family lawyer. We would follow his advice. They smiled weakly and returned to work. At noon, I bought a six-pack of Quincy's One Stop in Lowtown, the black section of Clanton, and went for a long drive in my Spitfire. It was late in February, unseasonably warm, so I put the top down and headed for the lake, wondering not for the first time just exactly what I was doing in Ford County, Mississippi. I grew up in Memphis and studied journalism at Syracuse for 5 years before my grandmother got tired of paying for what was becoming an extended education. My grades were unremarkable, and I was a year away from a degree, maybe a year and a half. She, Bibi, had plenty of money, hated to spend it, and after 5 years she figured my opportunity had been sufficiently funded. When she cut me off, I was very disappointed, but I did not complain, to her anyway. I was her only grandchild, and her estate would be a delight. I studied journalism with a hangover. In the early days at Syracuse, I aspired to be an investigative reporter with the New York Times or the Washington Post. Then, during my junior year, when my grades began their steady decline to the bottom of the class, I became captivated by the idea of working for a small-town newspaper. I cannot explain this attraction, except that it was at about this time that I met and befriended Nick Diener. He was from rural Indiana, and for decades his family had owned a rather prosperous county newspaper. He drove a fancy little Alfa Romeo and always had plenty of cash. We became close friends. Nick was a bright student who could have handled medicine, law, or engineering. His only goal, however, was to return to Indiana and run the family business. This baffled me until we got drunk one night and he told me how much his father cleared each year off their small weekly, circulation 6,000, It was a gold mine, he said. And so after my fourth year, which should have been my last but wasn't close, I spent the summer interning at a small weekly in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. The pay was peanuts, but Beebe was impressed because I was employed. But after 5 years at Syracuse, my grades were irreparable, and the well ran dry. I returned to Memphis, visited Beebe, thanked her for her efforts, and told her I loved her. She told me to find a job. At the time, Wilson Caudle's sister lived in Memphis, and through the course of things, this lady met Beebe at one of those hot tea drinkers' parties. After a few phone calls back and forth, I was packed and headed to Clanton, Mississippi, where Spot was eagerly waiting. After an hour of orientation, he turned me loose on Ford County. In the next edition, he ran a sweet little story with a photo of me announcing my internship at the Times. It made the front page. News was slow in those days. The announcement contained a horrendous misstatement that changed my life. I was born Joyner William Traynor. When I enrolled at Syracuse, I was J. William, a rather imposing name for an 18-year-old, but Vietnam and the riots and all the rebellion and social upheaval convinced me that J. William sounded too corporate, too establishment. I became Will. Spot at various times called me Will, William, Bill, or even Billy, and since I would answer to all of them, I never knew what was next. In the announcement, under my smiling face, was my new name, Willie Traynor. I was horrified. I had never dreamed of anyone calling me Willie. I went to a prep school in Memphis, and then to college in New York, and I had never met a person named Willie. I wasn't a good old boy. I drove a Triumph Spitfire and had long hair. What would I tell my fraternity brothers at Syracuse? What would I tell Beebe? After hiding in my apartment for 2 days, I mustered the courage to confront Spot and demand he do something. I marched into the Times office and bumped into Davy Big Mouth Bass, the sports editor of the paper. "Hey, cool name," he said. "Folks will think you're pretty cool with a name like Willie. Think of Joe Willie."
"Who's Joe Willie?"
"Joe Willie Namath."
"Oh, him."
"Yeah, he's a Yankee like you, from Pennsylvania or someplace, but when he got to Alabama, he went from Joseph William to Joe Willie. The girls chased him all over the place."
I began to feel better. In 1970, Joe Namath was probably the most famous athlete in the country. Within a couple of weeks, the name was beginning to stick. Everybody called me Willie and seemed to feel more comfortable because I had such a down-to-earth name. I told Beebe it was just a temporary pseudonym. The Times was a very thin paper, and I knew immediately that it was in trouble. Heavy on the obits, light on news and advertising. The employees were disgruntled, but quiet and loyal. Jobs were scarce in Ford County in 1970. Spot told me the entire county was mine to cover. The paper had one other general reporter, Baggy Suggs, a pickled old goat who spent his hours hanging around the courthouse across the street, sniffing for gossip and drinking bourbon with a small club of washed-up lawyers, too old and too drunk to practice anymore. Margaret, the secretary, was a fine Christian lady who ran the place, though she was smart enough to allow Spot to think he was the boss. She was in her early 50s and had worked there for 20 years. She was the rock, the anchor, and everything at the Times revolved around her. She and I became gossiping pals, and after a week she confirmed what I already suspected, that Mr. Caudle was indeed crazy, and that the newspaper was indeed in dire financial straits. But, she said, the Caudles have family money. It would be years before I understood this mystery. In Mississippi, family money was not to be confused with wealth. It had nothing to do with cash or other assets. Family money was a status, obtained by someone who was white, somewhat educated beyond high school, born in a large home with a front porch, and partially reared by a beloved black maid named Bessie, or Pearl. When I talked to the Caudle family lawyer, he explained, rather succinctly, the real value of their family money.
"They're as poor as Job's turkey," he said as I sat deep in a worn leather chair and looked up at him across his wide and ancient mahogany desk.
His name was Walter Sullivan, of the prestigious Sullivan and O'Hara firm. Prestigious for Ford County. 7 lawyers. He studied the bankruptcy petition and rambled on about the Caudles and the money they used to have and how foolish they'd been in running a once profitable paper into the ground. He'd represented them for 30 years, and back when Miss Emma ran things, the Times had 5,000 subscribers and pages filled with advertisements. She kept a $500,000 certificate of deposit at Security Bank, just for a rainy day. Then her husband died, and she remarried a local alcoholic 20 years her junior. It was the beginning of the end. The second husband ran off with her money, and Miss Emma, heartbroken, became a recluse.
"It was once a fine paper," Mr. Sullivan said. "But look at it now. Less than 1,200 subscriptions, heavily in debt, bankrupt."
"What will the court do?" I asked.
"Try and find a buyer."
"A buyer?"
"Yes, someone will buy. The county has to have a newspaper."
I immediately thought of two people, Nick Diener and Beebe. Nick's family had become rich off their county weekly. Beebe was already loaded, and she had only one beloved grandchild. My heart began pounding as I smelled opportunity. Mr. Sullivan watched me intently, and it was obvious he knew what I was thinking.
"It could be bought for a song," he said.
"How much?"
I asked with all the confidence of a 23-year-old cub reporter whose grandmother was as stout as lye soap. "Probably 50,000. 25 for the paper, 25 to operate. Most of the debts can be bankrupted, then renegotiated with the creditors you need."
He paused and leaned forward, elbows on his desk, thick grayish eyebrows twitching as if his brain was working overtime.
"It could be a real gold mine, you know."
Beebe had never invested in a gold mine, but after 3 days of priming the pump, I left Memphis with a check for $50,000. I gave it to Mr. Sullivan, who put it in a trust account and petitioned the court for the sale of the paper. The judge, a relic who belonged in the bed next to Miss Emma, nodded benignly and scrawled his name on an order that made me the new owner of the Ford County Times. It takes at least 3 generations to be accepted in Ford County. Regardless of money or breeding, one cannot simply move there and be trusted. Once word spread that I, a young green alien from Memphis, had bought the paper for $50,000, or maybe $100,000, or perhaps even $200,000, a great wave of gossip shook the community. Margaret gave me the updates. Because I was single, there was a chance I was a homosexual. Because I went to Syracuse, wherever that was, then I was probably a communist. Or worse, a liberal. Because I was from Memphis, I was a subversive intent on embarrassing Ford County. Just the same, as they all conceded quietly among themselves, I now controlled the obituaries. I was somebody. The New Times debuted on March 18, 1970, only 3 weeks after the midget arrived with his papers. It was almost an inch thick and loaded with more photos than had ever been published in a county weekly. Cub Scout troops, brownies, junior high basketball teams, garden clubs, book clubs, tea clubs. Bible study groups, adult softball teams, civic clubs, dozens of photos. I tried to include every living soul in the county, and the dead ones were exalted like never before. The news was light and breezy, absolutely no editorials. People love to read about crime, so on the bottom left-hand corner of the front page, I launched the crime notes section. Thankfully, 2 pickups had been stolen the week before, and I covered these heists as if Fort Knox had been looted. In the center of the front page, there was a rather large group shot of the new regime. Margaret, Hardy, Baggy Suggs, me, our photographer Wiley Meek, Davy Big Mouth Bass, and Melanie Dogan, a high school student and part-time employee. I was proud of my staff. We had worked around the clock for 10 days, and our first edition was a great success. We printed 5,000 copies and sold them all. I sent a box of them to Beebe, and she was most impressed. For the next month, the New Times slowly took shape as I struggled to determine what I wanted it to become. Change is painful in rural Mississippi, so I decided to do it gradually. The old paper was bankrupt, but it had changed little in 50 years. I wrote more news, sold more ads, included more and more pictures of groups of endless varieties, and I worked hard on the obituaries. I figured it would take a year to become profitable, and at first, revenue increased slowly. Then Rhoda Castlelaw was murdered. I guess it's the nature of the business to sell more papers after a brutal crime when people want details. We sold 2,400 papers the week before her death, and almost 4,000 the week after. Ford County was a peaceful place. I owned the paper for 10 years, from 1970 to 1980, and we reported very few murders in Ford County. None was as brutal as Rhoda Castlelaw's. None was as premeditated. 30 years later, I still think about it every day. Rhoda Castlelaw lived in the Beech Hill community, 12 miles north of Clanton, in a modest gray brick house on a narrow paved country road. The flower beds along the front of the house were weedless and received daily care, and between them and the road, the long, wide lawn was thick and well cut. The driveway was crushed white rock. Scattered down both sides of it was a collection of scooters and balls and bikes. Her two small children were always outdoors, playing hard, sometimes stopping to watch a passing car. It was a pleasant little country house, a stone's throw from Mr. and Mrs. Deese next door. The young man who bought it was killed in a trucking accident somewhere in Texas, and at the age of 28, Rhoda became a widow. The insurance on his life paid off the house and the car. The balance was invested to provide a modest monthly income that allowed her to remain home and dote on the children. Shortly after the death of her husband, Rhoda planned to return to her family in Missouri. She was not from Ford County, nor was her husband. A job took them there. But the house was paid for, the kids were happy, the neighbors were nice, and her family was much too concerned about how much life insurance she collected. So she stayed, always thinking of leaving, but never doing so. Rhoda Castlelaw was a beautiful woman when she wanted to be, which was not very often. Her shapely, thin figure was usually camouflaged under a loose, cotton, drip-dry dress or a bulky chambray work shirt, which she preferred when gardening. She wore little makeup and kept her long, flaxen-colored hair pulled back and stuck together on top of her head. Most of what she ate came from her organic garden, and her skin had a soft, healthy glow to it. Such an attractive young widow would normally have been a hot property in the county, but she kept to herself. After 3 years of mourning, however, Rhoda became restless. She hired a young black girl from down the road to babysit, and she drove north for an hour to the Tennessee line where she'd heard there was some respectable lounges and dance clubs. She enjoyed the dancing and the flirting, but she never drank and always came home early. It became a routine, 2 or 3 times a month.
Then the jeans got tighter,
the dancing faster. The hours longer and longer. She was getting noticed and talked about in the bars and clubs along the state line. He followed her home twice before he killed her. It was March, and a warm front had brought a premature hope of spring. It was a dark night with no moon. Bear, the family mutt, sniffed him first as he crept behind a tree in the backyard. Bear was primed to growl and bark when he was forever silenced. Rhoda's son Michael was 5 and her daughter Teresa was 3. They wore matching Disney cartoon pajamas, neatly pressed, and watched their mother's glowing eyes as she read them the story of Jonah and the whale. She tucked them in and kissed them goodnight, and when Rhoda turned off the light to their bedroom, he was already in the house. An hour later she turned off the television, locked the doors, and waited for Bear, who did not appear. That was no surprise because he often chased rabbits and squirrels into the woods and came home late. In her bedroom, she slipped out of her light cotton dress and opened the closet door. He was waiting in there, in the dark. He snatched her from behind, covered her mouth with a thick and sweaty hand, and said, "I have a knife. I'll cut you and your kids." With the other hand, he held up a shiny blade and waved it before her eyes. "Understand?" he hissed into her ear. She trembled and managed to shake her head. She couldn't see what he looked like. He threw her to the floor of the cluttered closet face down and yanked her hands behind her. He took a brown wool scarf an old aunt had given her and wrapped it roughly around her face.
"Not one sound," he kept growling at her, "or I'll cut you kids."
When the blindfold was finished, he grabbed her hair, snatched her to her feet, and dragged her to her bed. He poked the tip of the blade into her chin and said,
"Don't fight me. The knife's right here."
He cut off her panties, and the rape began. He wanted to see her eyes, those beautiful eyes he'd seen in the clubs, and the long hair. He'd bought her drinks and danced with her twice, and when he'd finally made a move, she had stiff-armed him.
"Try these moves, baby," he mumbled just loud enough for her to hear.
He and the Jack Daniels had been building courage for 3 hours, and now the whiskey numbed him. He moved slowly above her, not rushing things, enjoying every second of it. He mumbled in the self-satisfying grunts of a real man taking and getting what he wanted. His movements became faster. He was mumbling louder. The wrought iron bed was squeaking. Didn't get used enough, he told himself. Too much noise, but he didn't care. The rattling of the bed woke Michael, who then got Teresa up. They eased from their room and crept down the dark hall to see what was happening. Michael opened the door to his mother's bedroom, saw the strange man on top of her, and said,
"Mommy!"
For a second, the man stopped and jerked his head toward the children. The sound of the boy's voice horrified Rhoda, who bolted upward and thrust both hands at her assailant, grabbing whatever she could. One small fist caught him in the left eye, a solid shot that stunned him. Then she yanked off her blindfold while kicking with both legs. He slapped her and tried to pin her down again.
"Danny Patchett," she shouted, still clawing. He hit her once more. "Mommy!"
Michael cried.
"Run, kids!"
Rhoda tried to scream, but she was struck dumb by her assailant's blows.
"Shut up!"
Paget yelled.
"Run!"
Rhoda shouted again, and the children backed away, then darted down the hallway, into the kitchen, and outside to safety. In the split second after she shouted his name, Paget realized he had no choice but to silence her. He took the knife and hacked twice, then scrambled from the bed and grabbed his clothing. Mr. and Mrs. Aaron Dees were watching late television from Memphis when they heard Michael's voice calling and getting closer. Mr. Dees met the boy at the front door. His pajamas were soaked with sweat and dew, and his teeth were chattering so violently he had trouble speaking.
"He hurt my mommy,"
he kept saying.
"He hurt my mommy."
Through the darkness between the two houses, Mr. Dees saw Teresa running after her brother. She was almost running in place, as if she wanted to get to one place without leaving the other. When Mrs. Dees finally got to her by the Dees garage, she was sucking her thumb and unable to speak. Mr. Dees raced into his den and grabbed two shotguns, one for him, one for his wife. The children were in the kitchen, shocked to the point of being paralyzed.
"He hurt Mommy,"
Michael kept saying. Mrs. Dees cuddled them, told them everything would be fine. She looked at her shotgun when her husband laid it on the table. "Stay here," he said as he rushed out of the house. He did not go far. Rhoda almost made it to the Dees home before she collapsed in the wet grass. She was completely naked, and from the neck down covered in blood. He picked her up and carried her to the front porch and shouted at his wife to move the children toward the back of the house and lock them in a bedroom. He could not allow them to see their mother in her last moments. As he placed her in the swing, Rhoda whispered,
"Danny Patchett. It was Danny Patchett."
He covered her with a quilt, then called an ambulance. Danny Paget kept his pickup in the center of the road and drove 90 miles an hour. He was half drunk and scared as hell, but unwilling to admit it. He'd be home in 10 minutes, secure in the family's little kingdom known as Paget Island. Those little faces had ruined everything. He'd think about it tomorrow. He took a long pull on the fifth of Jack Daniels and felt better. It was a rabbit or a small dog or some varmint, and when it darted from the shoulder, he caught a glimpse of it and reacted badly. He instinctively hit the brake pedal, just for a split second, because he really didn't care what he hit and rather enjoyed the sport of road killing. But he'd punched too hard. The rear tires locked and the pickup fishtailed. Before he realized it, Danny was in serious trouble. He jerked the wheel one way, the wrong way,
and the truck hit the gravel shoulder where it began to spin like a stock car on the back stretch. It slid into the ditch, flipped twice, then crashed into a row of pine trees. If he'd been sober, he would have been killed. But drunks walk away. He crawled out through a shattered window and for a long while leaned on the truck, counting his cuts and scratches and considering his options. The leg was suddenly stiff, and as he climbed up the bank to the road, he realized he could not walk far. Not that he would need to. The blue lights were on him before he realized it. The deputy was out of the car, surveying the scene with a long black flashlight. More flashing lights appeared down the road. The deputy saw the blood, smelled the whiskey, and reached for the handcuffs. The Big Brown River drops nonchalantly south from Tennessee and runs as straight as a hand-dug channel for 30 miles through the center of Tyler County, Mississippi. 2 miles above the Ford County line, it begins twisting and looping, and by the time it leaves Tyler County, it looks like a scared snake curling desperately and going nowhere. Its journey through Ford County is brief. It dips and forms a wide circle around 2,000 acres in the northeasternmost corner of the county, then leaves and heads back toward Tennessee. The circle is almost perfect, and an island is almost formed. But at the last moment, the Big Brown turns away from itself and leaves a narrow strip of land between its banks. The circle is known as Paget Island, a deep, dense woodland covered in pine, gum, elm, oak, and a myriad of swamps and bayous and sloughs, some connected but most isolated. Little of the rich soil has ever been cleared. Nothing was harvested on the island except timber and lots of corn, for illegal whiskey, and marijuana, but that was a later story. On the thin strip of land between the banks of the Big Brown, a paved road entered and left, came and went, always with someone watching. The road was built long ago by the county, but very few taxpayers ever dared to use it. The entire island has been in the Paget family since Reconstruction, when Rudolph Paget, a carpetbagger from the north, arrived a bit late after the war and found all the prime land taken. He searched in vain, found nothing attractive, then somehow stumbled upon the snake-infested island. On the map, it looked promising. He put together a band of newly freed slaves and, with guns and machetes, fought his way on to the island. No one else wanted it. Rudolph married a local whore and began cutting timber. Since timber was in great demand after the war, he became prosperous. The local proved to be quite fertile, and soon there was a horde of little Pagets on the island. One of his ex-slaves had learned the art of distillery. Rudolph became a corn farmer who neither ate nor sold his crop, but instead used it to produce what was soon known as one of the finest whiskies in the Deep South. For 30 years, Rudolph made moonshine until he died of cirrhosis in 1902. By then, an entire clan of Pagets inhabited the island and were quite proficient at milling timber and producing illegal whiskey. Scattered about the island were a half dozen distilleries, all well protected and concealed, all operating with state-of-the-art machinery. During the 1920s and 1930s, when alcohol was illegal and the nation was thirsty, Paget whiskey could not be distilled fast enough. It was shipped in oak barrels across the Big Brown and hauled by trucks up north as far away as Chicago. The patriarch, president, and director of production and marketing was a tight-fisted old warrior named Clovis Paget, eldest son of Rudolph and the local. Clovis had been taught at an early age that the best profits were those from which no taxes were extracted. That was lesson number one. Number two preached the marvelous message of dealing strictly in cash. Clovis was a hard-nosed, cash and no-taxes man, and the Pagets were rumored to have more money than the Mississippi State Treasury. In 1943, a strange event occurred in Ford County. An honest man was elected sheriff, or High Sheriff, as he is commonly known. His name was Koontz Lantrip, and he wasn't really that honest, but certainly sounded good on the stump. He vowed to end corruption, to clean up county government, to put the bootleggers and moonshiners, even the Pagets, out of business. It made for a nice speech, and Lantrip won by 8 votes. His supporters waited and waited, and finally, 6 months after taking office, he organized his deputies and crossed the Big Brown on the only bridge, an ancient wooden structure that had been built by the county in 1915 at the insistence of Clovis. Two of the deputies were shot in the head, and Lantrip's body was never found. It was carefully laid to rest on the banks of a swamp by three Paget Negroes. Buford, the eldest son of Clovis, supervised the burial. With the noble experiment of an honest sheriff behind them, the good people of Ford County elected one from the old school. His name was Mackie Don Coley, and his father had been the high sheriff back in the 20s when Clovis was in charge of Paget Island. Clovis and the senior Coley had been rather close, and it was widely known that the sheriff was a rich man because old Paget was allowed to move so freely out of the county. When Mackie Don announced his candidacy, Buford sent him $50,000 in cash. Mackie Don won in a landslide. His opponent claimed to be honest. After the Second War, the demand for moonshine began a steady decline. Since generations of Pagets had been schooled to operate outside the law, Buford and the family began to diversify into other forms of illicit commerce. They ran guns, stole cars, counterfeited, bought and burned buildings to collect insurance. In 1967, a younger Paget fled to Canada to avoid the draft. He drifted to California where he tried marijuana and realized he had a taste for it. After a few months as a peacenik, he got homesick and sneaked back to Paget Island. He brought with him 4 pounds of pot, which he shared with all his cousins, and they, too, were quite taken with it. He explained that the rest of the country, and primarily California, was token like crazy. As usual, Mississippi was at least 5 years behind the trend. The stuff could be grown cheaply, then hauled to the cities where there was demand. His father, Gil Paget, grandson of Clovis, saw the opportunity, and soon many of the old cornfields were converted to cannabis. A 2,000-foot strip of land was cleared for a runway, and the Pagets bought themselves an airplane. Within a year, there were daily flights to the outskirts of Memphis and Atlanta, where the Pagets had established their network. To their delight and with their help, marijuana finally became popular in the Deep South. For years, no one in Ford County had a hint that the Pagets were trafficking in drugs, and they never got caught. No Paget was ever indicted for a drug-related offense. In fact, not a single Paget had ever been arrested. 100 years of moonshining, stealing, gun-running, gambling, counterfeiting, whoring, bribing, even killing, and eventually drug manufacturing, and not a single arrest. They were smart people, careful, deliberate, patient with their schemes. Then Danny Paget, Gil's youngest son, was arrested for the rape and murder of Rhoda Castlelaw. Mr. Deese told me the next day that when he was certain Rhoda was dead, he finally left her in the swing on the front porch. He went to his bathroom where he stripped and showered and saw her blood spin down the drain. He changed into work clothes and waited for the police and the ambulance. He watched her house while holding a loaded shotgun, anxious to blast anything that moved. But there was no movement, no sound. In the distance, he could barely hear a siren. His wife kept the children locked in the back bedroom where she huddled with them in the bed under a blanket. Michael kept asking about his mother and who was that man. But Teresa was too traumatized to speak. She managed only a low groaning sound as she sucked her fingers and shook as if she were freezing. Before long, Ben